From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Few gardeners would dispute the fact that garden phlox is a worthy addition to the summer landscape, and nectar-seeking butterflies emphatically agree. But which varieties among the many offered at nurseries and in catalogs do the best job of both adding beauty and supporting beneficial insects? The genus phlox is our topic today, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden.
Regular listeners will be familiar with George Coombs, who manages the trial gardens at Mount Cuba Center Native Plant Garden and Research Facility in Delaware. George has helped us on previous shows to make our way through the daunting selections of Heuchera, Monarda, and Baptisia. Now, George and the trial garden team have spent 3 years evaluating 94 different sun-loving selections of phlox for eye and butterfly appeal and mildew resistance, plus 43 shade garden choices, too. So, hello, George. I can't wait to hear.
How are you? Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Yes. Whenever one of your reports arrives, I feel very lucky to get it because it's such a good read all the time. Do you write them? Do you write up the summary report? They're great.
I do write them. Yeah, they're a lot of work, but they always turn out really well.
Yeah, so it's like a whole reference book. They're wonderful. And of course, we'll give links to everybody where they can read them online and so forth with the transcript of the show. But I have to confess, George, I didn't even know that the genus phlox had so many species in it. I only knew the ones we commonly use in gardens. So tell us just a little bit about the genus and how you decided what to focus on.
Yeah, well, the main reason we wanted to trial phlox was really to look at phlox paniculata, the garden phlox, the common phlox that most people think of, that blooms in the summertime but is really prone to powdery mildew. But with all of our trials, we like to include as many different species as we can get our hands on, and so we kind of dove a little deeper into the genus to kind of get some things that were a little more obscure, a little different. So some of the other species that we looked at were things like Phlox carolina, Phlox maculata, Glabrorhema, Amplifolia, and so on. And really a lot of these are very different from the garden phlox that most people are familiar with. They tend to bloom earlier in the summertime, late spring, early summer. A lot of times they're much shorter, so they're just a very different type of plant. But in many cases, we found that a lot of those were really good performers. So they were some of the top performers in the trial that we highlighted, as well as different selections of phlox paniculata.
Interesting, because I think there was even a discovery of a species that isn't commonly grown in gardens, wasn't there? I can't remember in the report that I read.
Yeah, that's phlox amplifolia, and that was actually a plant that I never even heard of until we started, you know, kind of researching the trial a little bit more. And what we found is that a lot of Europeans kind of referring to Phlox David, which is a popular phlox paniculata cultivar, as Phlox amplifolia David. And so I was like, well, what is Phlox amplifolia? I kind of need to investigate that. And so what we found is that there is a species called Phlox amplifolia. It's pretty different from paniculata. They both kind of have the large panicles of flowers, but Phlox amplifolia actually is more of a rhizomatous grower, so it kind of spreads like a Monarda. It's about 2.5-3 feet tall, and it blooms a lot earlier. It blooms in early June, whereas most garden phlox start blooming in July. But the really interesting thing about it was that it doesn't get any powdery mildew. So it seems like something that maybe we should have been paying attention to all along, but nobody really was. So.
Yeah, so let's sort of spend some time on the garden phlox, the common phlox paniculata. What did you want to look at? You said powdery mildew, but I think in collaboration with your neighbors at the University of Delaware, you also looked into some more sort of scientific things, yes?
Yeah, so we were, you know, we're always interested in how these plants perform in the garden, but being Mount Cuba, kind of focusing on native plants, we want to know, well, what do these plants do kind of in the environment besides just being pretty? So the thing that we were kind of looking at with the phlox trial is we wanted to see, you know, what differences there were in their ability to attract pollinators. And so we actually had a graduate student as well as some volunteers here at the garden to kind of keep track of that. And what we found is that one cultivar in particular really attracted the most butterflies out of all of the sun-loving phlox types, and that was Phlox paniculata gina. And the really interesting thing is that that was also the top performer kind of horticulturally in terms of what blooms the most, is the most disease resistant, et cetera. So that was a really nice coincidence. But what they found is that even though this is kind of the one that's attracting the most butterflies, we are not really quite sure what characteristics about gina are bringing the butterflies in. And so kind of the interesting thing about gina is that its flowers are actually the smallest out of any of the kind of flower sizes of garden phlox. So they're about the size of maybe somewhere between the size of a pea and a dime. They're quite smaller than normal, which you would think maybe an atypical flower size might kind of deter butterfly visitation because they're not necessarily used to seeing that.
Right.
But for whatever reason, that's what they love. And so the kind of going theory is that, well, maybe that smaller flower size somehow makes it easier or faster for them to kind of move between different flowers and visit and get more nectar quicker and easier.
So we should say Gina is J-E-A-N-A, for those who are listening
right.
and not looking at the transcript, Gina. And it is very different looking. I only met it for the first time last year. It's very different. And when you say the flowers are small, I mean, there's still lots of them massed together into these, like, heads, so to speak, you know. But each individual one is small, is petite compared.
Yes. Yeah. The flower display is still, you know, very impactful, very, very showy. It's just the individual flower. They call it a pip in phlox. So that's the individual flower. The little pip is quite small.
P-I what?
P-I-P.
Pip. Oh, a pip, of course. I'm sorry, a pip.
Yep.
Yes. My father used to call me and my sister pips as well, so I don't know where that comes
exactly.
from, but yeah, whatever. one thing that I read, I think, in the report was that one of the sort of wonderings of the scientific aspect of this, looking at, you know, the appeal to butterflies, is that in breeding, you know, in sort of selecting phlox over the years, horticultural people, plant breeders, we haven't thought about what makes an ideal structure and nectar supply, you know, nectar supply for the native insects that have long used and co-evolved with these plants. So we may have made adjustments that weren't to their liking, yeah?
Exactly. It's kind of like, you know, when you're breeding for certain characteristics, unfortunately, you're always going to be ignoring a few others. And I think a really good example is the breeding that they did in tomatoes, where they were breeding for a very solid red color, but doing so, they also happened to breed out the taste, which you would think would be kind of important. But,
problem.
Kind of left to the wayside. So,
yeah.
So it happens when you're kind of doing focused breeding like that.
So the range of colors, Gina is what? How would you describe the color? Is it a lavendery pink, or is it pink, or what color is Gina?
I would call it more of a pure pink, almost a bubble gum, or like cotton candy pink.
Okay. And the range of colors in Phlox paniculata is not super wide, but it's not just. We have white. We have sort of more hotter pink, coral pink kind of shades.
Yeah, the natural color for phlox is really kind of like a bright, kind of garish pink, almost fuchsia colored. And then you've got anywhere thing from white to pale pink. There's kind of like really kind of coral orangey colors now. There's some that are almost a true red, as well as kind of pale violets and purples.
And some have eyes, like contrasting centers, so to speak.
Yep, and even there's some now that have like kind of a pinwheel pattern, the kind of stripes across the petals that are pretty interesting.
So what were some of the other like winners besides Gina, who seems to have won on many counts, mildew resistance as well as appeal to butterflies?
Some of the other ones that are really good are Phlox paniculata, Glamour Girl. That's a relatively new cultivar, but it's also compact. Gets to be about 3 feet tall, kind of a nice pinkish coral color. Robert Poor is kind of an old-fashioned cultivar.
Yes.
Very tall, gets to be about 5 feet. Kind of in the more traditional Phlox paniculata color, that kind of, you know, bright magenta pink color. It's a really nice one. Delta Snow is also one that was really mildew resistant. And that's been shown to be mildew resistant in several other trials too. So that's a good one for a broad part of the country.
Did you evaluate for duration of the bloom, like the length of the bloom season of the particular plant as well?
We did, and we found some of them were, you know, a little bit longer than others. I would say for the most part, they're all blooming for about 3, maybe 4 weeks.
Okay.
But unfortunately, it's really hard to gauge because so much of it just depends on the health of the plant. So the healthier plants are going to bloom longer.
Right.
And, you know, our trial, I will say that we really put them through the test. It was a very difficult situation when you're growing 90 different types of phlox all in one kind of confined space.
Ooh, yeah.
When these plants are prone to disease and you put that many in one spot, you're going to get, you know, incredible disease pressure. So they were suffering. And so I think, you know, in certain cases where plants were a little more inferior, a little less disease resistant, they may have bloomed longer in a you know, a personal garden where there was just one phlox or two. But we really kind of tested them to their limits.
So with the mildew now, let's see, what happens in the summer? We get the warm days and cool nights, and I think that promotes our powdery mildew kind of moments. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's usually when it starts to show up. It's kind of, you know, early to mid-June. It depends on the weather. But as soon as you start getting, like, those nice, warm 80, 85-degree days, but the nights are still getting cool, mm-hmm. you know, down to the 60s, that kind of creates the perfect temperature fluctuation for mildew to first develop and then spread. And so it just kind of really can take off in those kinds of conditions.
And it used to be recommended, I mean, I can sort of remember being 100 years old. I can remember in vintage garden how-to books, one of the suggestions would be that as our phlox clumps, our phlox paniculata clumps, were emerging in spring, we were to crawl around and knock off every other emerging little shoot, so to thin the clump before it emerged fully so that it would have more air circulation. That was one of the kinds of crazy things that I was taught to do as a young gardener. What really is a good idea? Is there anything that helps?
Well, you know, I think air circulation is always going to be important. You know, kind of reducing that humidity level right around the plant is helpful. But I think, you know, really the easiest thing to do is to just, you know, try and pick a cultivar that's been proven to be disease resistant.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we've definitely seen, you know, quite a range in terms of just, you know, natural resistance to powdery mildew. But then also, I think the thing that we kind of forget about most often is that plants really get disease when they're stressed. And so
yes.
The important thing is to really put your plant, whatever it might be, to put it in the site where it's going to most likely thrive. And so for phlox paniculata, they really prefer a sunny spot that is somehow cool with moist, consistently moist soil, which sounds like the, you know, the perfect Goldilocks that doesn't exist, but they naturally occur kind of along stream banks and, you know, the edge of floodplain zones. So they're used to kind of having access to water, but not necessarily being kind of flooded themselves. So that's kind of why they do well in those kinds of situations. So I think having kind of a richer soil, something with a lot of organic matter, and then if you are able to kind of provide a little extra water during times when it does get dry, it's going to make a world of difference in kind of reducing the powdery mildew.
I forgot to ask, what is their native range in the United States? Like, how wide-ranging are they? Are they in eastern part of the country or what? Do you know? I haven't looked at the range map anywhere.
You know, I haven't looked at a lot of myself, but I think they're pretty broad spread, probably from Pennsylvania down to the deep south.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where in the garden you tortured them in the trial garden, cheek to jowl in a monoculture of phlox and more phlox, but where in the garden, and I know at Mount Cuba, some of your colleagues have been combining native perennials into, you know, landscape settings and so forth. Where do phlox appear? What these tall garden phlox? What do they look good with? Or any ideas about using them? Or should they be in the back of the border to hide their messy legs if they get a little mildew or what?
Well, a lot of it's going to depend on the size of the plant that you want to use. So, you know, I personally think that a lot of the taller ones, at least in our trial, were much more vigorous. So I'm more inclined to use those than some of the more compact varieties. So
uh-huh.
I would recommend, you know, kind of back of the border. They're really great in meadow situations or kind of naturalistic plantings where you can kind of really crowd them around with other plants that even though you're kind of creating the bad situation where mildew might develop, having a diversity of plants kind of surrounding them, typically ones that don't get mildew, really doesn't kind of add to the disease pressure.
Okay.
So those are, you know, I think other tall perennials, grasses, things like that are things that I would typically combine phlox with.
Mm-hmm. So any other standouts that we should be looking for? And again, you know, we should qualify it saying you're only in one place. You're in the Mid-Atlantic. You're in Delaware. You're doing these trials there based on your conditions. But there are probably extrapolations for a wider range of situations about their mildew resistance and so forth. But any others that you loved?
One that I think is really good that's not quite too popular is one that's called Phlox Carolina Kim.
Kim?
And that's another species. Yeah, Kim. I like the woman's name.
Oh.
And so that's just it's just a really nice 2-foot tall, like prolifically blooming phlox that doesn't get any disease, doesn't get any kind of powdery mildew or leaf spot. It's just a really clean cultivar. So that's something that I think should be more popular than what it is.
I wonder why not. I wonder why those haven't been.
I think most people, when they think of phlox, they think of just the tall garden phlox with
right.
the big, giant, you know, flower heads, and anything else is kind of lesser by comparison.
Okay. So Phlox Carolina Kim.
Yes.
Okay. All right. That's one to be on the lookout for. And then, of course, there's the other phlox. And as I think I said in the introduction, you did trial... 43 shade garden choices as well. Is that right? They were in a couple of different species, I think.
Yeah, we figured we had some space in the shade garden, so we're like, well, let's just kind of go hog wild on phlox altogether.
wild guys down there at Mount
Cuba. We can't control ourselves.
Yeah, party on.
So we had about 40 different kinds of shade-loving phlox, and they both represented Phlox divaricata, which is the woodland phlox.
Yes.
And Phlox solanifera, which is the creeping phlox. And so both of those are shade-loving types, but they're very different looking. So the creeping phlox, Phlox solanifera, is more of a mat-forming ground cover.
Yeah.
And then the woodland phlox is more of a typical clump-forming perennial, about 1.5 feet tall. But they do bloom at the same time, so you can kind of think of them in the garden as... providing color at a similar point.
What month is that for you now?
What's that?
What month is that for you that they bloom?
For us, it's in April.
Yeah, okay.
But the timing in April can fluctuate depending on the weather and the season. So
not that the weather fluctuates at all lately at all. At
Never.
All.
Yeah.
Never. Mm-mm. No. George, I don't know if I told you in our correspondence lately that it was almost 70 degrees here in Zone 5B in February, and that was just a few days after an ice storm. So we're doing real good over here.
You know, I don't mind the 70 degrees. The plants probably have a different opinion, but
yes,
I don't mind.
Yes. It's crazy. Anyway, that's a digression. So these two sort of, are these like semi-shade kind of denizens?
Yeah, these are shade, semi-shade. Typically, they want to grow in, again, a nice, moist, fertile soil. But they don't want to be in something that's really wet. So they want to have well-drained. Otherwise, they'll typically rot during the summer months.
Uh-huh. And I saw, I think it was with the stolonifera, which I believe you said were easier to grow. Are they a little more robust?
Yeah, we found that actually the varicatas were challenging, and I don't know if it was because we just didn't really get the healthiest plants in when we purchased them, or
uh-huh.
if they're just naturally more difficult. I've heard from other gardeners that were kind of seeing us struggle. They're like, yeah, we had the same problem. They're great when they get established, but kind of getting them to establish can be more challenging. Whereas the Phlox solanifera, I think because they're more of a ground cover, they're a little more aggressive, a little more vigorous, that they were just much easier for us to grow in the garden. So
there was
I think for a beginner person, those are a lot easier.
There was a great combination suggestion, actually, because for people who are, and a lot of listeners and readers ask me about this, about sort of, you know, a living ground cover, so to speak, you know, making these, like I always call them, mosaics of plants that play well together but give you sort of a long season of interest without tons of, sort of complex care regimen. You suggested sort of using the stolonifera with a few other things, I believe, yes?
Yeah, so we're actually, that's kind of one of the things that we do best here at Mount Cuba, I think, is kind of combine these plants and almost like a ground cover, kind of where they all knit together and their seasonal interest throughout the year. So the kind of plant pairings for Phlox bullinifera that work really well are sunflower, which is Tiarella cordifolia, Pennsylvania sedge, which is Carex pennsylvanica, and then maidenhair fern, which is adiantum. And together, those are just a really nice, they put on a great show in the springtime with a fresh flush of either foliage or flowers. And then the ferns and the carex kind of really carry you through the rest of the year with kind of a textural interest, too. So,
and the Tiarella, the Tiarella foliage, I think, is adorable, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that kind of, in other words, not thinking about, okay, I'm buying 10 of this one plant and that's it. And then you're going to be disappointed because then its moment is over and that was the whole thing, right? And so, yeah, these little, like, more combinations, the way nature might plant actually is a lot smarter, I think, besides
beautiful. And mixing those plants together, you don't really have to pay attention so much to this needs to go exactly here.
No.
This needs to go exactly there. They kind of do their own thing and live with each other very well. So you kind of just step back and enjoy.
Right. That's why I sort of think of it as mosaics as opposed to designs. Because do you know what I mean? Like the way that things sort of, you know, it's irregular. It does its own thing.
Yeah. They self-regulate and self-sort themselves.
Yeah. So I have to ask you, we have a few minutes left, maybe 3-4 minutes. And I have to ask you, what in the world are you trialing next? Because you just keep going, George. I don't know how you guys do it there. What's next?
They keep cracking the whip, so I keep cracking out the trials.
You're not going to run out of native plants to trial, are you?
I don't think we will, at least not in my career, no.
Okay.
So right now we're halfway through a trial on sneezeweed or helenium.
Oh, that's going to be a great one. Those are great plants.
That's something that I think a lot of Americans aren't really aware of. They're kind of taller. They tend to bloom in the fall, late summer, fall. They're not very popular perennials here, but Europeans love them. There's tons of cultivars available in Europe.
The places I've seen them in gardens used prominently were years ago in English gardens, you know.
Yep.
And then knowing they were Native American, I was like, what's the problem? But they were not popular here.
Yeah, so we've got about 40 different cultivars of those.
Wow.
Half of which aren't really available in the United States yet, so we're kind of looking at some of the ones that the Europeans love as well as the ones that we already have access to here.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty excited about that. And we just started 2 new trials, one on Echinacea.
So
we actually looked at, we looked at coneflowers about a decade ago, actually, when kind of the coneflower craze was just getting going with all the different colors coming out and what have you. But most of those cultivars that we trialed and kind of reported on a decade ago are no longer available, so we don't really have any kind of guidance to give to people anymore. So we're kind of looking at those again to see what's changed in the industry, if they're performing any better than what they were a few years ago.
They were sorry creatures. Those first ones, it was all flash and dash. The tag looked beautiful because they were breakthrough colors that weren't expected. And then, you know, a year later, the plant was dead. And I mean, I'm not, you know, the world's best gardener, but boy, if I can't grow a cone flower, if I can't keep it for 2 years, it's not much of a plant. Do you know what I mean?
Well, and they're generally pretty expensive, too. So when you're spending you want it to live at least for a couple years, you know? So,
Yes.
And then the other trial that we just started is on sedges or carex. So that's something that I think maybe most homeowners don't, you know, really will appreciate, but it's certainly a plant that a lot of landscape architects and things are really kind of getting keen on that are these are very utilitarian plants that are great for ground covers and just really versatile workhorses that were just kind of scratching the surface on, you know, where these plants can grow and what kinds of conditions they can tolerate. So we've got over 80 different species of those that we're going to be looking at for the next few years.
Wow. Busy. Well, George Coombs, I'm always, like I said at the beginning, I'm also happy to get another one of your reports and always really pleased to speak to you. Keep up the good work, because I think you're really, the Mount Cuba effort really is going to continue to change and evolve, influence great gardening and great plant selection. So, you know, you say the heleniums aren't available yet, but guess what? If they're in your report, they're going to be available. So
we're going to try it.
Yeah.
That's our goal.
Yeah. You'll move the market, as they say. So thank you for making the time today, George.
Thank you.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from Time Owing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/A Way to Garden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Now don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden, and happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.